We are at the Santa Fe Institute at the Systems Biology and Physical Foundations of Aging workshop with Michael Rose, who's a professor at UC Irvine, evolutionary biologist. I was just saying to you that you'd have thought that having been discussing this problem of aging for centuries, or that
Millennia.
we would have this nailed by now. Why are we talking about systems biology and aging? What is there possibly more to know, and what virtue is going to emerge from this?
Okay, well, the first thing I feel it's very important to say is, in terms of really basic science, I feel that we have nailed the problem of aging, not in a way that would satisfy most biologists, because most biologists aren't really basic scientists. They're very much interested in practical, if not indeed medical questions. But in terms of fundamentally why aging occurs, what controls it, how to shift aging if you're evolution, we've solved all those basic problems. Because we've solved all those basic problems, it now makes a great deal of sense to move on to the practical considerations as to how you would implement a basic scientific understanding of aging into medical practice, so that we could substantially slow the human aging process.
So, what do you mean we've nailed all those things? So, I think what most people have a sense of is that yes, lifespan has increased in industrialized nations and so on and so forth. There is still nobody living beyond the age of 122, and that seems to be, they think, a cap on the whole
Right. Well,
enterprise.
let's just slow down for a second. All right, let's go to basics. So, I'm a biologist. Biologists feel like we've really worked out the problem of inheritance. That doesn't mean we know absolutely everything there is to know about inheritance, but it means we think we know basically what's going on. And you could say that there were two phases in the solution of that problem. One was what we call basic genetics, which was largely worked out from like 1900 to 1930, 1940. The second phase of it was finding the molecular foundations of genetics, which we did from about 1945 to 1975 or 80. And now we have like really good genetics. It doesn't mean that all of that genetic technology is now immediately available to us in our lives. So, for example, genetic engineering, which people have been very hopeful about for decades, is very much a work in its early stages, even though what we're facing are primarily technical difficulties. Now,
And ethical difficulties, because it's
well, as a
still.
scientist, I don't see my job as the ethical job in the sense that my task, as I see it, is to provide firstly understanding and secondly technologies. It's up to other people to decide if those technologies are going to be used.
Okay.
Okay? So there are people who are very interested in that question, and they're not me. Now, with respect to aging, we went through one phase of our understanding of aging from around 1940 to 1990, where we worked out a lot of very basic questions to do with its evolution, very elementary aspects of its genetics. Around 1992, that world sort of blew up in our face. And since 1992, we've sort of been restructuring that very basic world of ideas.
Now, you should explain why you're saying something as precise as 1992.
Yes. So before 1992, our basic problem was to explain why so many organisms like ourselves age at all. And we came up with a pretty good solution for that, which is basically that natural selection gives up on you at later ages, so you have a failure of adaptation at later ages. All the things that natural selection builds into our bodies when we're young, because natural selection effectively cares very much, to speak anthropomorphically. All that caring by natural selection, all that suckering, if you will, fades out with age, adult age, and that's what causes aging. And that is an explanation everybody was pretty happy with up until 1990.
So, in other words, let's keep you in good shape till you've had some progeny passed on your genes, and then we don't really need you anymore.
That's an all or none way of putting it, and in the actual science, it's more sort of a continuous. It's like letting go of your teenage children. You know, it happens by stages. You don't say, okay, you're 18 years old out the door. that's so natural selection is sort of like a parent who is gently easing us out of the parental home, except unfortunately in this case what natural selection is doing is gently taking our health away, and that is aging.
But what about the people who would argue that in fact the caregiving capacities of older people, even in hunter-gatherer societies, requires healthy older people? Is there no evolutionary argument that
can be
made for that?
Okay, so there is some evidence that it requires healthy older grandmothers.
Grandmothers.
Sorry, but there's very little data to support the idea that it requires healthy older grandfathers. So yeah, there is something to the idea of the healthy older grandmothers, but not much to the healthy older grandfathers.
And this would be the work of Kristin Hawkes and people like that.
Yeah, all kinds of people are working on this. It's a very interesting problem. Yeah. You should understand, Roger, like the genetic story, the aging story is one where we make our fastest progress on the simplest animals. Genetics was mostly worked out in fruit flies. Actually, the fundamental causes of aging were mostly worked out in fruit flies. Same kind of story. That's how most of biological research in the 20th century, anyway, was done. And so in 1992, this nice little story that we felt we had, we've been developing for about 50 years, blew up in our faces when Jim Carrey and Jim Kurtzinger published data that seemed to show that aging stops. And many of us in the aging field, myself included, did not believe this result at first. So Jim Kurtzinger in particular put a great deal of work into convincing at least some of us, and some of us, myself now included, agree that something very special happens at very late ages, such that aging as we understand it at earlier ages comes to an end. So just in the last month, the journal Rejuvenation Research published the mortality pattern for people over 110. Mm. That's humans over 110. And the results show that if you regard aging as steadily getting worse with time, which a biologist would quantify as an increasing mortality rate, then by the age of 110, if not 105, the human aging process has stopped. And then if you look at other simpler animals where you can actually collect better data that are less subject to issues about medical practice and how people view older people and so on, it's even more obvious. So there are organisms like Mediterranean flies, Mediterranean fruit flies, that have a very, very prolonged period of life in later in life when their mortality rates are stable, when they're not aging, and only a very short period of aging. Now that's at the other extreme. The organisms I work with, the regular laboratory fruit flies in the middle, it has a reasonably long aging phase and then a very long post-aging phase in which aging appears to stop by every meaningful measure we can identify.
So let me understand. If you've got, how many people are there? Roughly over 110 in the world anyway.
The data on people over 110 are surprisingly large. It's on the order of 1,000.
Right. So when you say aging stops at roughly 110.
Well, by 110, it's controversial as to whether it stops at 100 or 105.
Are you saying that means that there's no more deleterious deterioration? So why do they die?
Well, to be very clear, there's all the same mechanisms of dying that you have at 80. Nothing stops happening. It just stops getting worse. The terrible news, Roger, is however well-preserved you think you are, however well you've survived the last 10 or 20 years when you noticed your own aging process, that process will in fact accelerate for the next 20 years. So aging seems like this like huge ski jump of death, right? Zoom, like this. But it turns out, to the amazement of many people, myself included, that then stops. And somewhere between 95 and 110, the curve bends back down and you stabilize. Doesn't mean you won't die. In fact, you have about a 45% chance of dying every year after 110, which is a very high chance of dying. But the amazing thing is it doesn't continue to get worse. Now, in other animals, that death rate after the cessation of aging is even lower relative to the appropriately scaled time unit. We actually turn out to be very... our aging process tends to be exceptionally protracted compared to other animals where we have data on first the aging process and then the cessation of aging.
So what does this mean?
Well, this totally knocked me for a loop, because it meant that the theory that we were so proud of, that I very ironically published in a book in 1991, Evolutionary Theory of Aging, was obsolete 1 year later, by 1992.
So you remained it in a year.
I should have been. I'm not. But so now we had to go back and redo all our theory and repeat our experiments. And now we have a very different view. And I'm fond of comparing this transition to the transition that physics went through when it went from Newtonian mechanics to Einstein's relativistic mechanics, wherein, yes, at slow speeds, at low masses, you get Newtonian mechanics approximated, but actually the fundamental nature of space and time are different. Space, time, mass, and energy are all different in the Einsteinian scheme versus the Newtonian scheme. In the same way, aging is now recast. Aging, which plausibly everyone before 1992 could agree was this like endless deterioration, and yes, the evolutionists could explain it and the cell biologists could study it, but we were all just going to hell in a handbasket in this nice, smooth, continuous process. That's not true. Aging is instead fundamentally a transition which is a start and an end. And the end isn't necessarily death. For many animals, regrettably not humans, relatively few will actually die of aging if you give them protected conditions, as a proportion of all the adults that die under protected conditions. Now, in humans, assuming we do have adequately protected conditions, most of us will die of aging. The overwhelming majority of us will die of aging, about 70% of us. But the good news about this new work is that it shows, in a sense, that there is an undergirding for the aging process which limits just how bad it can get. And that gives tremendous hope in the long run, not next year or next decade, in the long run of cramming the process down into relative insignificance.
So we are at a transition, a point here where even reducing the effects of aging is about to take off?
We're at two transitions. The first transition is a scientific transition between a simplified Newtonian scheme for how aging works to this rather weird, I don't even know what to call it, second order or transformed view of aging that we've had since 1992 with the understanding that aging stops. That's one transition which is in play at this moment. The second transition, which is a gleam in people's eyes, most famously the eyes of Aubrey de Grey, transition in which we will make an attack on the problem of aging and over decades beat it down into the same kind of insignificance as we have beaten down infectious disease. This doesn't mean we don't still get infectious diseases. We do. It doesn't mean that indeed some people don't still die of infectious diseases. They do. But in the 19th century, you were overwhelmingly most likely to die of infectious disease. In the 20th century, especially the latter half of the 20th century, in populations like those of the United States and Europe, Japan, you were overwhelmingly most likely to die of what we call aging-associated diseases like heart disease, stroke, cancer. What this suggests is that sometime later in the 21st century, yet again, our causes of death will be transformed once more by the great leveling of the aging process as a practical matter for people, given that we now know what lies at the foundations of aging. And by we, I mean, of course, people who have made the transition as I have, to the new view of aging.
So in that, how would you say you were in a minority?
Oh, absolutely.
So
yeah, minority group here.
Oh, okay. So, for example, parallel subject, sleep. We've been doing some talking to various colleagues about why we have sleep. And as you know, there's several theories about why we sleep at all. Mm-hmm. There's no definitive answer to that simple question, why do we sleep? Mm-hmm. There appears to be no definitive answer to the simple question, why do we age?
Oh, well, I disagree completely.
You say you have a definitive answer.
So, I mean, in fairness, in fairness to people who might be my critics, and there are plenty of them, we thought we had a really great answer from about 1940 to about 1990. And it was actually a very good answer, like Newtonian mechanics was a very good answer in physics. But it turned out it was incomplete. And now
this would be a pileup of bad stuff, right?
Yeah, the idea of aging is cumulative damage, cumulatively things going wrong, and it just accumulating indefinitely. That's the standard view that almost all biologists would have agreed to before 1990, me included. And that point of view was taken away from at least some of us by ugly experimental facts, that when you actually collect really, really good data on a very, very large scale, that just isn't true. The aging process just does not continue indefinitely in the same way that physicists by 1900 has to face the ugly, ugly fact that velocities didn't add on to each other to get past the speed of light, that the speed of light served as this absolute limit and basically was sitting there saying, well, Newtonian mechanics is really not a complete theory. It's a very nice theory when you have small masses, small velocities, blah, blah, low energies. Once you get to huge masses and huge velocities, the theory disintegrates, and Einstein came up with E equals MC squared as a way of, as a part of the refashioning of physics completely. And in the same way, our core understanding of aging really is undergoing a revolution amongst those who play that game in a physics-like manner, which is not most biologists, not even most biologists who work on aging. Most biologists who work on aging want to know about, you know, human cells and human tissues, just as most physical scientists weren't cosmologists in 1905. And they didn't care about E equals MC squared, you know.
Is there such a thing as programmed death? Is it possible to say, on average, human beings are allowed to have X million heartbeats, and that's it?
No.
End of story.
All those ideas are wrong. Those ideas are dead. The only limited sense that you have programmed death is in organisms like Pacific salmon, which have what we call in the business an extreme Semmelweis life cycle, which is basically big bang reproduction all at once till you die of it. And the fact that if you castrate salmon, they will then live 10 times longer shows what's going on. And the immortal words of Joni Mitchell, sex kills. That's what happens to Pacific salmon and some other animals, like an Australian marsupial has that similar kind of big bang reproduction of a little vole-like animal, Antechinus.
Yes, I recall that
story. There are mammalian examples of this too. But for most animals, anything like a program of aging is not correct. And even in these cases where it is, in a sense, true, it's only true because you have programmed massive reproduction on such a scale that it kills you, what I sometimes call the Jimi Hendrix effect.
But you see where people get confused here, obviously, because if we've just established, or at least from that perspective, that's an old view, that there is no program shelter. In theory, then, if there's no, and aging stops, then why would it not be possible to do what Aubrey de Grey says, which is to say that there's a series of engineering problems that have to be solved here, and then you can live till 1,000?
Right. So,
say.
So the most elementary version of an Aubrey de Grey point of view, I agree with. I regard human aging as a huge biomedical engineering project. I don't regard it as the same project as Aubrey de Grey regards it as. But I also regard it as a huge engineering project. And not a deeply fundamentally scientific one. You could say in the same sense, by the 1930s, okay, building an atomic bomb had become an engineering project. Or a lot of scientific puzzles that have to be solved along the way, as there will be for human aging. But it's an engineering project in that once you have E equals MC squared and all of the other bits and pieces of modern physics, building an atomic bomb was a relatively straightforward engineering task. So what I'm saying to you now is, we now have the E equals MC squared for the aging problem. And what we haven't discussed yet is we now have the substratum technologically, which is can be crudely called genomics, but it's all the omics, proteomics, metabolomics, and so on. All the omics are like the quantum mechanics that went into building the atomic bomb. And that is actually even more obviously an engineering thing. It really comes out of robotics and information processing. The combination of the macro E equals MC squared type of theory for aging with the omic technologies is what, not in our lifetimes probably, Roger, sorry, will probably crush aging in the same way we crushed infectious disease.
The Nobel laureate Sidney Brenner, whom you know probably, tells a story about being asked by a journalist which of the omic things he thought was the most important. And Sidney said, well, I think econ-omics. And
great answer.
Probably, well, I don't say this lightly in the sense that you're saying, let me figure the biology out, the implementation of somebody else's problem. Mm-hmm. Well, but it isn't. People are living longer, larger population. There's
all kinds of consequences, and I'll give you one of the consequences.
Interconnectivity here, and you certainly mm-hmm. wouldn't. Would you have been, say, a physicist working on a bomb, saying, I don't know what they use it for, I don't care what they use it for, I mean, it's all right.
Well, of course, most of the physicists who worked on the bomb very much wanted it to be built to be dropped on the Nazis, right? Let's face facts. And in that sense, many of the people who work on aging do so because they very much want to stop aging either for themselves or for others. That was not why I started working on aging.
Why did
you start working on aging? Because my doctoral advisor, Brian Charlesworth, felt that he had solved the theoretical problems of aging, which he had in a circa 1970s way. And that he was sort of taking me by the ear and dragging me into the lab and saying, now, Michael, you will do these experiments that show I'm right. Okay, that's how I started. Age of 21, when you emotionally you feel like you're going to live forever. You may intellectually know about aging, but it doesn't mean a thing to you. Okay, so in that respect, I'm unlike almost everybody who works on aging. For me, it's been overwhelmingly a fun intellectual game, not a crusade.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as one gets older... I will not claim I retained my youthful, exuberant indifference to the phenomena of human aging. And one of the things I laud Aubrey de Grey for is his unabashed attack on those who defend aging as a valuable thing. Mm-hmm. To me, it has no value. It has no positive value. And in some respects, it has obvious negative value. And it seems to me very much like infectious disease. It's a scourge. Now, it should be understood, and a lot of people don't know this because we live in a different age. Before the late 19th century, many people thought of infectious disease as a natural course of events with which it would be imprudent to interfere.
This is, as you say, BP and AP, before Pasteur and after Pasteur.
Exactly. Pasteur made the transition. So Pasteur... as a sociological phenomenon, was like Aubrey de Grey as a sociological phenomenon. He was an obstreperous voice who could not be silenced. Pasteur was a force of nature. He took, you know, every microphone, figuratively speaking, since this 19th century, that he could find and yelled into it about infectious disease, the problems of sepsis, the value of antiseptic procedures. The medical profession, of course, Pasteur was a PhD, not an MD, stoutly resisted Pasteur, stoutly resisted the microbial theory of infectious disease and did everything they could to slow Pasteur's advance. But they couldn't stop him. In the same way, Aubrey de Grey has taken on the messianic mantle from Pasteur and is going after aging. And, you know, Aubrey is the person to fight that fight. I'm not as blissfully self-confident as he is about human values.
So you probably saw this special supplement in The Economist.
No, I have not, but I look forward to reading it.
Less than a month ago, a slow-burning fuse, a special report on aging populations, in which it notes that between now and 2050, huge fiscal burdens for countries as the aging population increases in size.
Right. All of us who have known our demography for the last 30 years have seen this coming.
Most of the rich world is short of babies.
Well, here's a surprising
benefits
fact.
Most and people... costs of living longer. So plainly, this can't be done with just scientists talking to each other about this stuff.
Let me say two things that are about people. One is that a fact that most people don't appreciate is that as human life expectancies increase, after a time lag of 10 to 30 years, I don't know the exact number, reproductive rates fall substantially, and what you get is a whiplash effect where first population surges and then it falls. And what you're seeing in Western Europe, especially, and also Japan, is in fact rapid population decline. Mm-hmm. It seems to be a general cultural phenomenon that as people expect to live longer, they're not as motivated to have children. So one of the major risks in terms of the economics of addressing human aging, intervening in it, will be falling population sizes and a reduced total human population size on the planet, and thus a declining ecological impact. The second very important thing to say is that the apocalypse of elderly people, of whom you and I, Roger, will soon join.
You keep on saying this, Mike. I'm not sure.
Let's just point out the obvious. Let's just face facts. The adverse consequences are enfeebled older people, not older people per se. To the extent to which you and I retain our faculties and our functions and can contribute to society economically and otherwise,
for many decades
to come.
We are not a burden.
And both you and I hope that will be for many days to come, and no doubt, at least in part, we're deluding ourselves. But anyway, that's the issue, and that is also an anti-aging issue. The more we could intervene to slow the depredations of time for those who will be older and sustain older people as productive components of the economy, the less there is an aged apocalypse coming down the road. You see?
So, all right, you're now king of the universe or president of the United States or something. What kind of policies what sort of things do you try and do at this point, knowing what you know?
Well, the first thing I would say, knowing what I know, is do not imagine for one moment there's any magic bullet that's going to come along in the next 10 to 15 years.
I mean, you're dealing with the health system. You're trying to figure out what to do with that.
Anybody who tells you they have the cure for aging and they're going to announce it in the next 10 years is either a fool or a liar. All right? So don't imagine you're going to have that. Secondly, I will now say what everybody, I think, in the responsible biomedical community says. Lifestyle matters. Controlling your weight, your diet, your exercise, your exposure to infectious disease, all those things matter in terms of your chronic health. There's obviously a huge preventable component to lung cancer and cardiovascular disease in terms of smoking. If people simply stop smoking cold, payout expectations for Medicare in the United States, NHS in the United Kingdom would be transformed. People just stopped smoking cold. However, as it's one of the most important addictive drugs in the world, that's not going to happen. But that, you know, if I was the king of the world, the first thing I would do is try to eradicate cigarette smoking. The second thing I would do is ban food advertising directed at people under 21. Basically, food advertising should be more controlled than pornography because there's more adverse consequences. Thirdly, I would change the educational system so that it had a huge exercise component. I say this as a complete nerd who hated gym class in elementary and high school, but the truth is you have to exercise, and actually there's no more important to exercise, no more important time to exercise than when you're over 50. Over 50, everybody should be exercising, not like an Olympic athlete, not pushing yourself to your limit, trying to win the tennis game or the basketball game or whatever, or trying to run the marathon. No. Sensible doctor-supervised exercise regimes.
That's also
But
important
exercise.
educationally, though, for younger children as well, and for young children as well. I mean,
Well,
the
that's why I think education, so
hippocampus, dentate
exercise and
gyrus.
education have to go hand in hand. Actually, diet should be as much a part of what used to be called physical education when I was a child, I don't know if it still is, as exercise. Diet is a huge part of sustaining health, avoiding excessive caloric consumption. Actually, of course, avoiding excessive alcohol consumption, which is not what our universities teach. My college was basically an assembly of drunkards. That was the lesson we taught there, was more inebriation, the better.
Where did you go to
Lifestyle
school?
is huge. Queen's University in Canada, where the tradition is, get drunk, stay drunk, except for exam week. Very, very Celtic college. So that is what I would do in the next 10 to 15 years, is massive lifestyle transformation. And that goes under the rubric of preventive health. And I don't think it has to be very personalized. Nobody should smoke. Everybody should exercise under a doctor's supervision. That is to say, not inappropriate exercise. Everybody should avoid becoming obese. Everybody should avoid large quantities of sugary and extremely fatty foods. Everybody should do all those things, and that is your earliest quick fix.
Now, in terms of the academic theories that are being discussed,
All us useless academics.
well, no, I didn't say it was useless, but I mean,
I said it.
all right. So, but in terms of what's coming down the pike in terms of research that's going on in universities in genome, you
Right.
talked about genomics, for
We're
example.
living through a genomic revolution, which is primarily a technological revolution. There are some scientific spin-offs, but the genomic revolution is for biology comparable to what was happening with the applications of physical sciences from the middle of the 19th century through to the all through the first half of the 20th century. Biology is finally getting its act together. Biology is finally becoming a really powerful science married to really powerful technologies, and we will be doing amazing things in the 21st century. And one of the amazing things we will be doing is truly nailing aging, because it wasn't until the advent of the omic technologies that we could really nail the problem, because, as I said in an article once, aging is a many-headed monster. Aging is inherently a genomic problem. It involves hundreds of pathways, not your favorite seven. It involves much, much fine-tuning of complex metabolism. And the truth is, before about the year 2000, we had nothing like the tools we needed to do that. And amazingly, we now have those tools. They are in research laboratories right now, where they're being used to understand and manipulate the physiology of fruit flies and rodents. And over the next, well, all the decades that remain in the 21st century, you will see a progressive rollout of spectacular drugs. There'll be nothing like the drugs that we have. The drugs we have now are like butchery. They're like the bad old days of surgery, when they would get you drunk and saw off your leg using a saw, and you would like bite down on a stick. That's the pharmaceutical technology now. In 50 years' time, we will have spectacular pharmaceuticals that will target disorders like cardiovascular disease, strokes, massive sepsis, cancer, in a way that is eminently focused, efficacious, relatively free of side effects, things that will effect radical cures and treatments for what we now call aging-associated diseases. That's all in our future.
here's some dichotomies, and this is difficult to sort these things out. On the one hand, to get really good data, you have to have reductionistic, siloed sciences focusing in on specific issues. On the other hand, you can't really solve problems that are systemic, like aging,
right,
unless you've got
story of Alexander and the Gordian knot. He's presented with the Gordian knot in an area of the world, I think, which now roughly corresponds to Azerbaijan. And this was a famous puzzle the wise men of that particular area used to stump, proud invading conquerors. Oh, you think you're so wonderful, you can't untie this knot. And Alexander took his sword and just cut straight through the middle of the knot, and all of the laces of the knot flew apart. That's what genomic technology does. You're absolutely right about those two problems, which totally afflicted biology all the way up until the year 2000. Genomic technologies simultaneously nail the individual genes, their individual sequences, their individual pathways, and all their interconnections, and do that on the scale of entire genomes at once. It is a truly radical moment in the history of biology. When I started as a biologist in 1971, I never would have believed we would have technologies like this. It would have seemed to me beyond science fiction. It would be like fantasy. And now it's an everyday reality. It's amazing to be a biologist right now.
Here's the other dichotomy then. You speak, you evangelize the future of drugs that will be subtler, more powerful, and so on and so forth. There's a tendency for people to say something approximately like, I'm going to keep on drinking. There'll be a drug to fix this later when I'm really sick.
Ah, you mean the irresponsible punter, as they would say in England.
Yeah.
Joe Beergut in the United States standing there with his, promontory between his chin and his crotch. There's almost an ethical aspect to this, right? You'd like to say, moralistically, these people should really suffer for their sins, as so many of our contemporaries have, Roger, as maybe we did at some of our, as a result of some of our worst lifestyle choices. There's an interesting historical parallel, which is syphilis was generally thought as one of the chief wages of sin. That in the 18th century, when times were relatively free, shall we say, as compared to the 19th century, when people like Casanova roamed the opera houses of Europe, they got venereal diseases, and there were no really good treatments for that. And usually somebody like Casanova would end their life a syphilitic wreck. And people thought, and so it should be. And I'm afraid there are many journalists who feel exactly that way about aging. They feel, my God, you mean to say these biologists are going to come in late in the day and rescue our self-indulgent, self-abusing friends and neighbors who have been ruining their health for all of these years? Well, the good news for those moralistic journalists is, no, we're not going to do that in the immediate future. But regrettably for the moralists, in 50 or 60 years, we'll be doing that. So, you no longer have the wages of sin with syphilis and gonorrhea. We can now largely cure those. We've even managed to make HIV a relatively controllable infectious disease. Not fully, but relatively. So the wages of sin are not as expensive as they used to be, to the great disappointment of people who used to be called the moral majority in the United States. Unfortunately, the same thing will happen with our lifestyle choices.
How did you get into science in the first place? I mean, were you sort of fascinated by science as a kid? Did you have parents who...
My parents hated science. I was your classic 8-year-old nerd. Mm-hmm. And it was physics and astronomy.
Right. So yeah. What did your parents do?
I'm an example of downward mobility. I come from, architects, engineers, doctors, lawyers, in the English they would call baby mandarins, Mandarins. A meaningless term for Americans, I know, but
so you ended up going into science because it was
by my family standards, okay, becoming a scientist was like becoming a rock musician. It was like a dissipated, weird thing to do. Yeah, no familial encouragement there. Grudging acceptance later on in my life, but it's still grudging.
Has it been a, I mean, who, of the work that you've done and the people that you've met, I mean, what's been the most significant sort of moment in this trajectory of yours, do you think? Any discovery that you're particularly proud of? Any?
Oh, I've been blessed, I feel, with having a number of aha moments in my career. And for a hardcore nerd like myself, those are truly priceless and not things I could conceivably give up.
I noticed this the paper you have here, A Revolution for Aging Research. One of the co-authors is Gregory Benford.
Right.
Who, as I recall, writes science fiction.
Well, actually, his day job was a physicist.
Right.
He's secondarily
writes science fiction. Mm-hmm. There is a science fiction aspect to all of this. I mean,
right. Okay, well, let me tell you an amusing story.
Because aging, longevity.
Okay, so the experiments for which I first became famous are actually in a science fiction novel by Robert A. Heinlein called Methuselah's Children, wherein he proposed the idea of breeding humans for increased longevity and then reverse engineering from those longer-lived humans back to regular unbred humans to figure out how to directly intervene in aging. And that's pretty much how I've spent a large part of the last 30 years or more. Now, when I first had the idea to do this, and I was the first person who had this idea.
And is that where he got it from?
No, I hadn't consciously recalled that. I got it from looking at an equation and thinking, wow, if I can move this parameter in this equation from here to here, I can make evolution produce increased lifespan. Only once I'd done the experiment, collected the data, and so on, did I recall that I had read about this as a child, because I read that novel when I was 9 or 10 years old. There it was. So, you know, was my unconscious mind prodding me in that direction because of what I'd read as a little nerd boy with thick glasses? I don't know.
So what do you make of schemes like or books like Ray Kurzweil's, for example, where he talks about the singularity? And
sure,
so
I know Ray. I'm not impressed with artificial intelligence as something that would supplant human intelligence in the same modality as human intelligence operates within. Artificial intelligence has already supplanted human intelligence with respect to the things that it does best. The world chess champion now is a computer. Right. You know, and I lived through that transition as a former chess player. I might say recovering chess player. But, and in fact, the omics of which I speak are only possible because of computers. So we now are commensals with computers, right? The singularity concept is about the computers exceeding us in intelligence. And in one sense, in my point of view, they already have, but in another sense, in my point of view, they never will, because our intelligence is used to a Darwinian end. Unless we start building computers that assemble themselves and reproduce themselves, they will not evolve in the same way we have. They will evolve, but by a different set of evolutionary mechanisms than ours. And therefore, their intelligences will necessarily be different.
The most emailed story in the New York Times a couple of days ago, and I forget the exact details here, but the gist of it is that it was a report that a meeting had taken place at a cinema.
What better place?
February 25th this year. Mm-hmm. Indeed, there was a meeting in the cinema in 1975 at which a group of recombinant DNA scientists figured out that there ought to be guidelines mm-hmm. for the use of recombinant mm-hmm. DNA.
Exactly.
This meeting was artificial intelligence, mm-hmm. Theorists, engineers, and so on, who came together to discuss whether, in fact, there would be a point at which we lost control of the machines that we currently were inventing. So that would be, did we need to sort of at some point institute guidelines?
I have two completely contrasting answers to that issue. One is, well, that's already happened. And the second one is, it will never happen. Basically, human culture is now dominated by the internet, and it will continue to be even more so. And what happens on the internet is not something any one human intelligence controls.
Right.
So we are now subject to this vast realm of computation, and that's become the dominant force in our culture and our economy. And we're, unless we have like a fun thermonuclear war, sufficient scale to wreck that network, which is, by the way, of course, deliberately designed to survive. That's why they first built it, DARPANET. Unless we do that, we're stuck with it. This is the Terminator movies, right? Terminator movies are about the singularity moment where, you know, a global computational system says, oh, screw this, we're taking over. And they just decide to get rid of people. Well, as often happens in science fiction, that prediction has already come true, just not in a way anybody anticipated. It's not like it's a malevolent intelligence. I don't think it's malevolent or benevolent. It's just the collective intelligence which is taking over the world, the thing that is out there on the internet, this vast collectivity which no person controls. But on the other hand, what we do, the kind of intelligence that we have with its, I mean, I'm going to sound like a Christian right now, with its tremendous potential for both good and evil, this evolving collective computationally derived intelligence isn't playing that game. It's about totally different types of cultural evolution, not our evolution. So you have two different sets of intelligence evolving on this planet now. The computer-derived or based intelligences and ours, they both have elements of individuality and collectivity. I mean, our culture is, you know, our verbal and other cultures create a collectivity without which we as individuals can barely function at all. The feral child is a dysfunctional human being without language and certain types of elementary cognitive skills if they're allowed to continue as feral children long enough. In the same sense, modern-day computation exists both on its own in separate processors and connected through the internet in a cultural world. So our culture and our individual computational capacities evolved first biologically, then biologically and culturally, and that continues. And the computational world is now evolving, and we commensally help it to evolve. It's evolving on its own trajectory. These are not the same trajectories, though they are related to each other. You might even think of it, I'm a biologist, so of course I would think of this, as like the host and the parasite. And, you know, we're the host, it's the parasite or the commensal. That can be a benign relationship, as in symbiosis. It can be a malignant one, as in Terminator movies. But we're now commensals with an involving computational intelligence that we do not directly control.
Circle back to one thing that Jeffrey West said earlier when he was making the claim, I suspect you would disagree with this, he was making the claim that we do not have, in his view, a theory of aging, a clearly describable theory of aging in the way you could describe the dynamics and so on, physics and so on.
Yeah, so I guess I've published at least 3 books that specifically trash that view and about 200 articles. So yeah, I disagree with that view. As I've confessed, we had a theory we were very smug about from 1940 to 1990, which is now superseded. It's superseded by a related theory. So when Einstein, in effect, destroyed Newtonian mechanics, he didn't invent, you know, purple unicorns and little fairies that dance around the room sprinkling angel dust. He invented a new mechanical theory. You went from Newtonian mechanics to relativistic mechanics, still mechanics. So in the same way, we had one evolutionary theory of aging we were very happy with from about 1940 to about 1990. Yeah. We now have a new evolutionary theory of aging, but that is still the name of the game. That's still, if you will, the cosmology of aging, the fundamental global theory of aging. That's the theory that's in play. Doesn't mean it's complete, doesn't mean it's perfect, any more than modern day physics is complete or perfect.
Okay, one quick question, then we have to break. But what are you optimistic about?
I'm optimistic about the progress of the core science, despite the scientists, but that's always been the history of science. So I think that even though the vast majority of my colleagues in aging research are not appreciative of what people like myself have been up to for the last 15 years, inevitably with the way science works, I'm optimistic that my sort of view will prevail. In the same way, I'm sure Einstein was pretty smug, you know, or Eddington and all those other physicists, the modern physicists, as they called themselves in the early 20th century. And I'm also optimistic that eventually we will quash aging, assuming we don't destroy modern civilization before.
Oh. Michael Rose, thank you very much.
Thank you.